Tonight we have two great poets, Nan Sweet and Maurice Kenney, and we're going to get started without further ado. And we will have an intermission between the two poets, and at that time, I recommend that you go over to this table to my left, your right, where there are numerous books and River Styx t-shirts, and avail yourself of all of them. And there is one correction for the program for this year that I know of so far that I am very excited about. In March, one of the people has been changed as well as the date. Minnie Bruce Pratt is not going to be coming this year. Instead, sorry, but Marilyn Hacker is. Yes! The power phone call. Anyway, and that reading will be with Peggy Shinner on March 23rd. So I highly recommend that you come to see that. Nanora Sweet writes poetry and criticism from a feminist and historical perspective. She has published in River Styx, Del Mar, Webster Review, Minnesota Review, and Ascent, English Journal, Blake, and Illustrated Quarterly, Studies in Romanticism, At the Limits of Romanticism, and such. She teaches at the University of Missouri-St. Louis and is proud to be faculty advisor for its literary magazine, LitMag. What the Riverfront Times once said of an UMSL education could be applied to the magazine's title. It's generic, probably a good thing. She also thanks the UM St. Louis Women's Poetry Group for reading and writing with her this year and a half. And we'll be hearing from several of those women later in the year. At present, she is trying to finish her book on the romantic woman poet Felicia Hemans and also edit a collection of essays on Heman. Without further ado, Nan Sweet.
Thank you, Janie. It's great to be here. Do let me know if you can hear. You guys here? Yeah, good. Some of these poems have a point, but some of them were written just for the aesthetic heck of it. They borrow points from elsewhere, maybe, as claims on respectability. In some way, I guess that's a theme here in my work, respectability, those calculations of the bourgeois life. Another theme is the city of St. Louis, this curiously European city on an American frontier. And another is love, okay? Because nothing happens that is not personal, I think, not part of a world where women and children and men know each other intimately and in the home and in the family. You know, some people, I think, have thought of my work as confessional, and you may want to visit that opinion yourself. The word I use is occasional, where the calendar of our shared living on a personal basis urges broad comment from us sometimes. And for me, this is especially true when that comment is coaxed out by those gods of middle-class life, one's parents, those parental voices, whether living or dead. So those are some of my favorite characters, I guess I'd say. The first poem begins in a dream of these voices. Otherwise, it is one of those without much point. And it had no occasion either. Until last week, one was thrust upon it with the demise of the St. Louis magazine from the Sunday Post-Dispatch. And the title of the poem is Rotogravure. That was your word for these Sunday pages printed in dreams, the showcase of a city bright with dyes, from the lead belt factories under the boulevard. But like all colors, these resolve themselves into one. In my latest dream of you, we meet along a distant avenue where I leave my car, hoping once more for repairs. We drive off into a morning already yellow, mordant, corrosive enough, we say, to fix dye into cloth or etch the news into metal. And we follow our ideas of print and paint into a room of the museum where, for the master, three people pose at table before one flared glass of red wine. I buy the postcard for its colors. Soon, in memory, it is evening, and you have called us away from the river, children not ready to come home. Not a dream. This is history as we both recall it. This submarine resting in the yellow light on the river, complex in all its latches. It has come 1,000 miles upriver to show us war. But that war was fought in radiant secrecy along this very river and on the atomic level. On a Sunday, still sleepy, I read old news and turn pages heavy with everyone's dreams. A cat's eyes are naturally yellow, they say, although a blue-eyed cat walks my chair backs and sleeps on the rotogravure. The way you did, we pick up these pages late in the day and pick up ink, too, the superstition of history. And the colors of the city fade. Quickly, the dwellings go into ruins. Only the rich can rebuild them, and there are never enough rich. It is yellowed in this scrapbook, the society page, still graced with your young smile. You illustrate June with November chrysanthemums. The honeymoon found you sharing strep throat with your groom at the mineral springs. The news, the print, the color, and the ink. Once more, you brought us to the museum, to the place where colors are sealed, and you've gone. And once again in our dreams, we've become lost in the pictures and do not want to leave. These days, sometimes the you who would harry me from my aesthetic musings that I enjoy, sometimes that you is my child and not a parent. This poem is dedicated to my daughter Jennifer, back there somewhere, whose spirit gets me to the ceremonies of academic life on time. It's called Academic Festival Overture. You offer me a ride, and it's a good thing, too, because I'll need all the checking over that I can get and that you always give. I might choose an unfortunate necklace again, one of my treasures from the 60s, say, like the vaguely oceanic carving on a string that inspires students to argue from hippie art to higher grades. Or I might try to leave for the commemorative luncheon with one or more long, loose gray hairs still festooned about my head. Standing there in your own dark, silky hair and dramatic eyes, these are treasures in themselves. You'll laugh me out of each new version of my mad look. But I might start reading my mail when I should be rolling the cat hair off my skirt or grabbing that extra Kleenex. Have you looked in the mirror, you say? And do you have your X, Y, and Z just that way? I used to patch your pockets for a day's worth of candy and add some treat money for a trip. All done. I think you'll let me venture into public yet one more time. This one covers some of the duties that are forced on us, evade them though we will, by age and its respectabilities. It's called List of Liabilities. I've been called upon to kill more things these days. The cat grows ill, the mice run wild, the trees break down, the weeds spread out. Who can afford such blemishes on property and life? A forester and veterinarian against my will, I call the saw for hire, the rent a hypodermic. Century tree and 7-to-1 centenarian cat, farewell. Those flowers that the vet sent were strange condolences, one killer to another. Meanwhile, I'm told that weeds and mice can't be beyond my low-tech style. Suburban stores all sell a total vegetation killer. And there is an inner-city hardware store that custom blends a poison just for rats. Okay, all right. I'll skulk from store to store, from house to yard. I'll glove out pellets for the mice, pour pails of biocide on plants. I'll trim my list of liabilities. And when I slacken, they'll proliferate. The work of life on life. We trimmers wish each other well. Happy killing, says the smiling, hold the hallmark, hardware clerk. Whoa. a couple of groans in there. This one has some more public circumstances, not to say historical. And I thank my colleagues in the UM St. Louis Women's Poetry Group for helping me to work on it. I think that as in most of my historical poems, St. Louis functions here less for its own sake than as a compass point for Transamerica. And yet it is St. Louis for its own sake, the way we all might love those stomping grounds that are ours. It's called Council Grove. A January thaw means that the snow turns into ice, then floats in icy water. It means that I drive out for sun and for the look of other people's houses. This time of year, old families sell their photographs and secrets to those who write new coffee table books. Thus money coaxes history into view in a town where General Grant met General Sherman. Exploits fade and power comes to light. My gift book says that William Clark ruled Jefferson's great purchase from a backyard up the station road and behind the old munitions plant. With Meriwether Lewis, Clark took 3 years to travel Great Louisiana. He spent one winter where the Columbia meets the sea. Back in St. Louis as territorial governor, he lost no time in taking as his prize the best-drained campground near the French King's town. He called this western slope his council grove. Lost now, forgotten. Its comforts once drew Indians to trade and trade, to camp all winter long and take what Clark would barter for their ancient hunting grounds. They say that close by Council Grove, Clark took more land and planted an estate called Winona. His son gave it a manor house trimmed in gingerbread. This lasted into the 1950s, which gave it an address and tore it down. I've driven out today, that address on my mind. I drift along the city limit line, where roads change names with every 100-year-old change in balkanizing local rule. And then I'm in a part of town where nothing qualifies as public, nothing ranks as history or as copy for the news. I ride on from home to poorer home, and no one stops me. The subtle grays of brush and board surround me in their style of unincorporation. Only numbers tell me that Winona's here. Then I see the governor's private grounds outlined in bright suburban reds and greens, the tract, a whole prefab lake against exurban gray, Clark's last barter with his neighborhood. Past this, I'm lost in loops along the station road, my major route. No numbers help me now. I turn up one slope, then down, and then turn again to find the real prize of my day, Clark's Council Grove. First, it is a relic street sign spelled out in oval letters, black on white, and then its great gaunt houses on a ridge, the governor's row. He must have parceled out to cronies when the Indians left, an empire now indistinguishable from the shambles of our local rule. But most of all, Council Grove is still the only warm, the only dry place on a sodden day. I stop to hear the melting, but the street is dry. Two liver-colored dogs lie across the pavement just as it turns most steeply to the sun. Less dogs than big slow bags of swollen sleep. Like Indians that knew Clark, they're drawn by warmth and drugged so well that they may never move. They stop my traffic now, my sunny drive across their slope. Then shoulders first and haunches next, they move and resume shape. Like everything today, they coax some power into view, then shift aside and let me by. You can see I'm already working up to 2003. I'm going to read a couple of sections from a somewhat longer piece, a sort of a triptych. It's another near North County setting, like Council Grove. In this case, it's the setting is Wellston. About 90 years ago, circa just before World War I. That, of course, is only the compass point. There are other times and other places, too. The poem is a blend of family history, fictionalized, of course, and of ethnicity, and of the motions of gender that place women in a treacherous world and then draw them back again, daughter to father. This poem started with a tub of sauerkraut. I still haven't finished it, I think. I'm going to read two panels of the three. It is a poem spoken to my two great aunts and my grandmother. I'm going to read panels for the two great aunts, Pearl and Amanda. It's called John Frederick, and his daughters. Pearl. John Frederick's oldest girl, so small and always lame, you married Mickey first, the Irishman who boxed for cash and beat you up at home. Your father had the vows annulled and took you home to tend his grapes. With ads and sales and crafty deals, he kept Carl Schurr's German newspaper in the black, a petty bourgeois factor in a world where Hegel and free thinking had their day. But World War I would put an end to that. Along came Johnny Glass, the carpenter. He built a shotgun house for you, his bride. His plans were true enough, but ages passed, that other German war, his floors had warped, and pinups lined his musty backroom walls. We kids came giggling home from visits there, the worst and sauerkraut you served for lunch, still heavy on our stomachs, topped by chunks of chocolate from the crock, still labeled kraut. But oh, the ants I saw there once. Your crock is gone, your house bulldozed, its small proceeds spent long ago to keep the family drunk afloat. And yet your house still furnishes my life and greets me in the chairs and couch of my ex-spouse. And Johnny's tools still hang, a stepson's gallant try at home decor. And in my basement hides an entire house that Johnny built, a shotgun made to scale for dolls. The steps are split, the walls spring out, the windows lose their cellulose. The paint, undaunted, keeps its lead-based reds and greens. And oh, the sauerkraut that I keep now, for me, all briny in a tub designed for frozen yogurt. Pearl, this all seems right. And the other panel, Amanda. Somewhat sharper personality than Pearl. Amanda, your father loved a waltz and grew the grapes for his own heavy wine. You loved a boy whose bride could only come from Italy. In time you married Emil, coarse and drunk enough to keep at home. The Great War came, and sales of German language news and ads no longer kept John Frederick's home afloat. The family dog called Kaiser finally left. He joined the troops, camped down the old rock road. Your town was nothing but a streetcar loop outside the city limits, ripe for sweetheart deals between the factories and the gang. The neighborhood went Irish. John Frederick died. You kept the calf. Excuse me, you sold the calf, but kept his house, it's privy below code by any rules. You worked the precinct while, with hat in hand, the mayor junketed to Asia well before the fashion. Thanks to you, the dolls, he brought from China and Japan or mine. Like Pearl, you had no children of your own. Her Johnny ran insane, was taken in at county. Your Emil spat himself to death. We gave you Christmas dinner, drove you back and forth. You slept until we came. Then while we stood, you wrapped some thrift store slip or scarf in last year's box. Your barbs were your protection, saved for dinner, passed around. with Della's pickles in the dining room. Back in the loop, the neighborhood went black and stayed democratic. You still work the polls. When death and the bulldozer came, who recognized John Frederick's rural place? His German arbor by the streetcar loop? All gone, except in your last look of scorn. This one's a little closer in compass. It's one of those that measures one of those occasions that is one person's, and I think typically everyone's, and perhaps, again, says something about different registers of what I call middle-class living. It's 10 years after the death of my father. It's called Father's Desk. Father's Desk. These past 10 years, when I've sat down the way you did to do my bills and reckon up my earthly goods, your desk would block my knees, or pinch my palms, or play drawer tug of war with every jerking joint along my arm. For stationery, both the desk and I were stuck with yours. While useless and unused, the underwood demanded housing where a person's legs should go. I figured out that cushions on a couch can hold my files, that piles of books will tend my pens, while knickknacks cradle my accounts. The freezer saves my will, of course, as lawyers recommend on call-in shows. For all your reckonings, the will you left could only measure out the hatred, pity, greed, and love of those you left behind. I think I'll use your desk for useless things, for Christmas stocking gifts. We give 1 year and then get back the next. The toy volcano, or the partial deck of old maid cards, or, perennial favorite, the lint remover whose remover's been removed. I'll store away the postcards, all the scenes we sent to those who'll never see them, scenes we'll never see again ourselves. There's time enough to shuffle fading places, well-worn gags. There's room enough in here to store this light vocabulary of the nondescript, these pennyworths of smile and sigh, these small dispersals that come back again. I think I'll read two or three more. This one's maybe just a touch longer than the other one because the parental engagements were just a touch more convoluted in this case. It's a poem in which the voice I'm trying to speak back to, I always did like to speak back, I think there's another word for that, is that of my mother. I don't know if any of you were bookish children, but I was a bookish and opinionated child. And in this poem addressed to my mother 15 years after her death, I take the occasion to think about what kind of a child I may have been in this very strenuous relationship with a very demanding mother. Maybe a kind of a child that I still am. It's a pretty bookish poem. It has some mythological beasts in it and some allusions to philosophy and literature. A couple of the mythological beasts, you know, there's Medusa, the snaky-headed monster who could turn you to stone if you looked at her. And there's the basilisk, king of the serpents, whose very look could strike you dead. A pretty pair of furies with which the dead can harry the living. And I've added to this an epigraph from one of my favorite poets, pretty daring to put her text near mine, Louise Bogan, from her poem, The Sleeping Fury, about a similar subject. And it goes, again addressed to her mother, "You are here now, who were so loud and feared, in a symbol before me, alone and asleep, and I at last look long upon you." It's called A Critique of Pure Reason. Yes, and that is not my title. It's the title of another book by Immanuel Kant, and the resemblance, I think, stops there. Okay. For 50 years, the world's been teaching me that it and I are not a perfect fit. A stubborn world rubs into stubborn me, and sprouting burrs and burses, I make sure the fit grows worse. So education goes, with me enrolled, and life the school. But this would come as no surprise to you, whose job it was to teach me not to botch the job of life. It's taken all of 50 years and more for me to understand that you both wanted and deserved a little girl, and not a proper basilisk of a child with pitiless gaze and legalistic ways, whose childhood based in first the Bill of Rights and then the Ten Commandments must have seemed a frightening, or more likely deadly boring thing to one who hoped for curls and smiles and bows, and if not smiles, for someone whom you could at least befriend. That was your question when, with lacerated lungs and broken joints, you waited, cradled, as we are, for death, not life. Are you my friend? One hopes a child will know the world cannot make sense, will not be fair, will not reward. You hoped, I think, that I might turn that sword that I call logic into the peaceful practice, understanding. You said that logic did not rule the world, at least for girls. Your harsh Medusa look thus met my basilisk. Your fear itself was logic, but I could not follow that. It led from world to room, from air to smoke, from swim to drink, from smiles to pills. These days, acquaintances and, yes, opponents still lament the deconstruction of the West, the sacrifice of logic to desire, or worse, to female vulnerability, still clinging to our unattractive youth. We teach before we're taught. Acquaintances, we thrive on rules and rights. Who'll teach us to be friends and to befriend? You learn the hard-hearted way we would not learn. I think I'm going to lighten with a couple more. Do I have time, Janie, for a couple more? Okay. A little bit shorter than that one. This is another personal occasion, an anniversary thrust upon my partner Martha and myself by our friends and dear ones. It's kind of light, now you see it, now you don't. 20 years. Some friends suggested that we celebrate out on the lawn these 20 years of ours. They'll call more friends and bring more chairs, a pool for kids, some frisbees just for me, a keg of Sprite for you, and citronella for the bugs. Our anniversary, they say. You know I like these little pointless holidays each year. St. Nicholas, St. Pat's, and most of all the 1st of May. But these salutes to an accumulation, what are they? Are we to be applauded just because we're rich? For shame, unless we plan to share. Congratulated that we've kept what all the world would have us sell. But then, who wouldn't hang around for dividends like these? The things that I remember and that you forget. The things you've come to know, I'll never do. Reminders regular as laundry. Pockets checked and stains removed. Perhaps against all odds, all odds. We're now a testament to faithfulness or to the concept of domestic partnership. All right, all right. It's hopeless to resist. Bring out the bat. Bring out the wiffle ball. And thinking summer and so forth, I'm going to read the last piece, also set in summer, and return us to some more of my serious points in this one, I hope. Like some of the others I've been reading, it's supposed to scan, you know, so dum da dum da dum da dum da dum, so you can see. But it alludes to the violence and the material conditions that lie behind American middle-class living, and it works with those from the wonder of a sheltered moment inside all of that, a sheltered childhood indeed in the 1950s. It's dedicated to my father and his colleagues, who built and maintained one of the systems essential to that life, just as essential and just as explosive, I fear, as alcohol. Indeed, it was the natural gas pipelines. And this is July, and it's Pipeliner's Picnic. It starts in the present, quickly moves to the past. It's always from the depth of someone else's yard that horseshoes ring. Some men have driven in the stake they used to play their game, their solemn game of iron rings and calculated throws. Your game, your time, your men dead 30 years, each hot July. Those men who worked all year made time to play, their collars loose, their smiles subdued, for games of iron. Those tubs of beer for them meant tubs of pop for us. Grapette and Coke, the brightest orange, the palest cream. Horseshoes for them meant shuttlecocks for us. The games of men meant bowls of food for all. Hot baked beans, and boiled potatoes cooled in salads, meat slow roasted over coals. Where are those men Who made a game of iron? How did they cool the beer they drank that day? How did they play with safety and make that their game? And these men who cooled the heat and warmed the cold and kept the home a regulated place. Thank you very much.